This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Just recently, the Nigerian government, the federal government, brought up the issue of state police. Now, what state police will do going forward, if it is implemented well, is that it empowers people, communities at the subnational level, with not just information, but the infrastructure for responding to threats.
That's United States Institute of Peace Nigeria Country Director Dr. Chris Kwaja on the insurgency and banditry occurring at specific regions in Nigeria. Details coming up. Also, Senegal's president-elect is vowing to fight corruption, rebuild institutions, and unite the country. And the UN Refugee Agency reports violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has reached a devastating level. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Senegal's president-elect Bassirou Diomaye Faye is vowing to fight corruption, rebuild institutions, and unite the country as he prepares to assume office. His election victory Sunday follows a political crisis sparked by outgoing President Macky Sall's failed attempt to postpone the vote. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo is in Dakar and has the story.
In his first public address, Senegalese president-elect Bassirou Diomaye Faye thanked his supporters and pledged to bring solutions to some of the problems he says his country is facing. I will govern with humility and in transparency, the president-elect said, adding, I will work to get rid of corruption in all sectors and will work toward rebuilding our institutions. Faye said, it's time to bring calm to the country after outgoing President Macky Sall tried to postpone the February elections until December, plunging the country into a brief political crisis. La réconciliation nationale et la He said the country needs national reconciliation and rebuilding our fundamental ways of living together. The pre-electoral crisis we lived through, he said, cost some people their lives and many were jailed. We hope to turn the page and reconcile people's hearts and the Senegalese people. Sunday's official election results have not yet been published, but Faye's supporters say they are satisfied with what they have seen so far. One supporter, Nyanya Fati, says we were hoping to win with over 70% in the first round, but it seems like we are 57%. It's only preliminary numbers, she adds. We hope the final number will be higher. Another Faye supporter, Sayer Kebe, says, we lived through a moment that almost pushed Senegal into chaos. But thank God everything is back in place now. We had a transparent presidential election. Earlier at the ruling party's coalition headquarters, Amadou Ba, the coalition lead candidate who lost the election to Faye, told reporters about a conversation he had with the president-elect.
Je lui souhaite.
Ba said, I wish him success and may God accompany him as he carries out his various missions and goals for our glorious nation and for the well-being of our population. As Ba's supporters try to digest their candidate's loss in the first round that saw 17 candidates vying for the top job, tensions of the last few months seem to be fading away and being replaced by the hope that Senegal's reputation as a beacon of democracy in the region will soon be restored. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
A South African court has dismissed the ruling party's case demanding that an opposition party be deregistered and banned from participating in the upcoming election. The electoral court said today the ruling African National Congress's party's objection to the Mkhonto Wesizwe's party's registration process had no merit. Former South African President Jacob Zuma, who headed the country from 2009 to 2018 and was removed amid wide-ranging allegations of corruption, left the ANC in December and is now leading the MK party. The May 29th elections are expected to be highly contested, with the ANC under pressure to remain in power following declining support in successive elections. Recently, in Nigeria's Kaduna State in Kajura community, 87 people were reportedly abducted. On March 9th, criminal gangs known as bandits attacked a boarding school in Gidan, Bakuso village in Sokoto State and kidnapped 15 children as they slept. 2 days before that, bandits abducted 287 students, including many girls, at the government secondary school in Kuriga Town in Kaduna State. On February 29th, more than 200 internally displaced people were abducted, many of them children, in the Ngala local government area of Borno State. It's a spate of truly alarming attacks, says United States Institute of Peace Nigeria Country Director Dr. Chris Kuwaja, talking to me by phone from Abuja.
Insurgency and banditry, though they are occurring at specific regions, insurgency in the northeast, banditry in the northwest, but they are Nigerian security challenges because they affect the Nigerian economy in totality, they affect the Nigerian people in totality, because monies that are supposed to be used for national development are devoted to dealing with banditry and insurgency in this region. So they are not issues that are peculiar to any region in terms of impact. But in terms of causality and the actors, they are regionally based, as we see, but the impact is spread across the country because there are many people in other parts of Nigeria whose relations or relatives are living and doing business in those areas where this act of criminality occurs.
What we see over time, according to Dr. Kuwaja, is the increased loss of monopoly over the control of the instrument of coercion, which in turn, he says, makes it easy for non-state actors to acquire arms.
Have access to arms, are using these arms against a country and its citizens, it presents a real governance and security challenges. One, in terms of the effectiveness of control on the part of the regulatory agencies with mandates to monitor the flow of weapons as well as the production of these weapons. Now, when you don't have that happening, then individuals have all manner of ways of acquiring weapons. The second is that over time, we've also seen the weaknesses associated with criminal justice administration in the context of prosecution or accountability by criminal groups. Now, where criminals don't account for their activities, it also emboldened other would-be criminal groups. The third part is that the transnational character of insurgency and banditry also tells a story of the weakness associated with border control, because both the individuals and the weapons have access to the Nigerian borders, come into Nigeria, and commit many of these atrocities that we see with very little done to deal with those issues. The fourth point is that community complicity with criminal groups, either out of fear or out of the incentives that they get from criminals, makes it easy for them to either support criminal groups or turn the other way in terms of their inability to really inform government of the activities or the arrival and the hibernation of criminal groups within these communities.
Because of the failure of the government to deliver public safety, trust in the government has gone down. Communities, Dr. Kuwaja says, are not eager to engage with the government when it comes to intelligence gathering, sharing information, with the goal of helping track, apprehend, and arrest these criminals.
Just recently, the Nigerian government, the federal government, brought up the issue of state police. Now, what state police will do going forward, if it is implemented well, is that it empowers people, communities at the subnational level, with not just information, but the infrastructure for responding to threats. Because we have a very unitary security arrangement in Nigeria where every decision on security comes from the federal government. And the time it will take for decisions to be taken to really deal with those issues at the community level is so long that criminals come into communities, attack communities, go before the security agencies come. So you are dealing with a reactive security structure, but government is thinking of making it more proactive.
The country representative for the United States Institute for Peace, Dr. Khawaja, tells me he had a lengthy conversation with the country's security advisor, as well as a constructive meeting with Nigeria's defense staff. The staff, according to Dr. Khawaja, has formulated a Marshall Plan to deal with the security situation in the country.
In terms of the Marshall Plan, we have a new president, we have a new chief of defense staff, we have a new national security advisor that came in after Buhari spent 8 years. My sense is that what is expected of them is to have taken stock, undertake a comprehensive review of what the security situation is, with a view to putting in place concrete plans for dealing with the issues as they see them on ground. One, in terms of partnerships, who to partner with. Two, in terms of logistics, the kind of logistics that is required. Three, in terms of infrastructure, what infrastructure for response do they need to put in place? And four, in terms of engagement, state citizens' engagement, what kind of engagement do we see or should be put in place with respect to government's own decisive response in a way that citizens key into such a plan, citizens are willing to support government with a view to winning the hearts and minds of the citizens. For me, this pathway to dealing with a very serious security challenge represents a major enabler for government, and it will help strengthen state citizens' relations in dealing with criminality and conflict in the country.
Ultimately, what may be most critical in ending this horrific mass abductions in northern Nigeria and stopping the abuses seen in security forces' responses to them is holding the perpetrators to account. If people keep getting away with such horrific crimes, Dr. Chris Khawaja, country director for the United States Institute of Peace in Nigeria, tells me these brutal crimes will keep happening. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The United Nations Security Council yesterday issued its first demand for a ceasefire in Gaza, effective during the ongoing Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The resolution passed 14-0 after the U.S. decided not to use its veto power on the resolution, which also demanded the release of all hostages taken captive during Hamas's October 7th surprise attack in southern Israel, but does not make a condition for the ceasefire. The resolution drew an immediate protest from the Israeli Prime Minister, who canceled the planned visit to Washington by a high-level delegation. Jim Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, discussed the resolution with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
Well, I'm glad it passed, but I am not pleased with both the way that the U.S. has interpreted their extension, nor their sense of satisfaction that they've done it. They've interpreted it as saying there's no change in policy, that it's not a demand for a ceasefire, and it's not a resolution that is enforceable. And they've made that point so that it undercuts the very importance of the resolution, and it makes their extension questionable. And it's more like a PR purposes than for actually helping to end the fighting. It does send a message that there's a distance between the White House and Netanyahu, but the distance between them is not enough to make a change in the direction of this conflict yet. Until the White House shows courage and conviction and takes the position that the fighting must stop or there'll be consequences, it won't stop.
Algeria's UN ambassador, the Arab representative on the council, thanked the council for finally demanding a ceasefire, but he said it is the responsibility of the Security Council to ensure the implementation of the provisions of this resolution. Is that doable?
Unfortunately not. Without the United States backing that, it will not happen. That's the problem with the abstention, and that's the problem with the way the U.S. has interpreted the resolution as not a requirement, not enforceable, and therefore simply sending a message.
The resolution drew an immediate protest from the Israeli prime minister, who canceled a planned visit to Washington by a high-level delegation and accused the U.S. of retreating from a principled position by allowing the vote to pass without conditioning the ceasefire on the release of hostages held by Hamas. The delegation was supposed to discuss with U.S. military alternatives to Israeli intention to invade Rafah. What could happen now?
Well, I think whatever is going to happen is what was going to happen. I don't think that whenever one Netanyahu didn't want to send a delegation, it was the president asked him to do it, actually insisted that he do it. Number two, I don't think there's a real interest in Israel in conducting a mass invasion of Rafah to begin with. I think that was a bogus argument to begin with. This is not about an invasion of Rafah. The Israeli military doesn't want to do it, and not just the U.S. And frankly, it would accomplish nothing other than kill thousands more and also kill many Israeli soldiers in the process. I think that we're seeing play out what Israel intends to do with Rafah, which is to make it a kind of a Jenin situation on steroids. They have the area completely cut off. They have the ability to go in and send squads to attack individual targets or groups of targets as they identify them. And I think they're content with that. Why Netanyahu made a fuss is more for domestic political purposes in Israel. It makes him look tough. It makes him look like he's standing up to the United States. The problem is that he doesn't have much to stand up to because the U.S. is not putting conditions, is not making absolute demands. And therefore, it's kind of easy for him to play this game of being a victim of U.S. demands and standing tall in the process.
But would that resolution negatively impact the mediation to reach a deal between Hamas and Israel?
I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that there's actually a movement toward a deal. The demands that Israel is putting on this are out of line with what Hamas is willing to accept and what they want. So I'm not sure I even see this happening. I don't believe that there'll be a release of all the hostages until there's an absolute ceasefire and an enforceable ceasefire. And so I think everything in between is just an effort to kind of buy time or stall or not make the decisions that have to be made.
That was Jim Zoghbi, president of the Arab American Institute, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The Pan-African Parliament re-elected Zimbabwean politician Fortune Charumbira its president yesterday, despite allegations of sexual assault and misappropriation of funds at elections in Johannesburg. His appointment was received with jubilation in South Africa, but disappointment in Zambia, which had provided an alternate candidate after the allegations surfaced against Charumbira. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Charumbira's win follows an 8-month forced break of the Pan-African Parliament, or PAP, or PAP, due to a lack of funds. He was president of the parliament but had to step aside when Zimbabwe's Senate and parliament were dissolved ahead of elections last August. The parliament also re-elected Masouda Mohamed Ladaf of Mauritania as first president. Some member states accused Charumbira of misappropriating funds, recruiting female members at PAP, as well as failing to give PAP a clear path towards solving problems faced by the continent. They also wondered why he was allowed to run after his niece accused him of sexual assault. Charumbira denies the allegations but admits the Pan-African Parliament has not served Africa well.
PAP itself should conduct itself in a manner that will build confidence in the public, in the citizens of this continent. I'm president of PAP, but certainly if you ask me, no, PAP has not quite conducted itself in order to build confidence in the public. So this bureau, that's item number one, beginning this week. What is it that we should correct about the image of Pan-African Parliament?
Speaking on behalf of Miles Samba, the defeated Zambian candidate, Joseph Kalimbwe said he was disappointed that Pan-African Parliament had failed to elect a candidate who wanted to focus the body on Africa's problems.
There's so many issues happening on the African continent. There's issues in Cameroon, for instance, of conflict between the Francophone speakers and the Anglophone speakers. We need a leader of the Pan-African Parliament to take a stance on that and help our people move forward. We also need to ensure that going forward in the what is happening in South Sudan, in the Congo, for instance, the richest mineral country in the whole world, is still at war with itself.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress Chief Whip Pemi Majordina defended Charumbira's election, saying there is no evidence to prove the allegations against him.
He started PAP in 2004 during its inception. The political stability that he has brought to PAP on the 1 year that he has been in PAP. So there's no need to change. You don't fix something that is not broken. So he must just finish term. He's left with only 12 months to finish the term.
The PAP's members are parliamentarians from all African countries, including about a half dozen countries that have recently undergone coups. Other members are dealing with Islamic insurgencies, major economic upheavals, and civil wars. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News in Johannesburg.
The UN Refugee Agency reports violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has reached a devastating level, forcing millions of people to flee for safety. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency is calling for urgent action to end the violence, which is threatening the lives and well-being of civilians in North Kivu, South Kivu, and Ituri provinces. It says official and makeshift displacement sites are overflowing, with people desperately seeking shelter from indiscriminate bombing and other human rights abuses. The UNHCR reports armed groups in the region increasingly are using heavy artillery. This amid reports of bombings targeting civilian locations in the Minova region of South Kivu. UNHCR spokesperson Matthew Saltmarsh says there are worrisome reports of indiscriminate bombings in Sake and Goma in recent weeks, in which more than 30 people have been killed and at least 80 wounded. He says he fears many more civilian casualties from ongoing bombings and from the threats posed by unexploded ordnance.
The latest reports from UNHCR teams are bleak. Families continue arriving at sites traumatized and exhausted by the attacks, scarred physically and psychologically. Many report being abused, some sexually, during their flight.
Saltmarsh says many children have been displaced by the renewed violence, and a large number of them have become separated from their families, exposing them to grave risks, including kidnapping, forced recruitment, mutilation, and rape.
In 2023, in North Kivu alone, there were over 50,000 reported cases of gender-based violence, more than half of which were rape. 90% of these victims were women and girls, while 37% were children.
The UNHCR warns risks for displaced and civilian populations are multiplying as violence continues. Saltmarsh says lack of security is preventing access to many people in need. He adds lack of international support is hampering aid workers from providing life-saving assistance to the many vulnerable people who can be reached. He says the UNHCR has received only 14% of the $250 million required for its operation in DRC this year. Without more funding, he warns the region's humanitarian crisis will only get worse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And thanks for listening to the